tune out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Wednesday, the 11th of February, 2026, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Well, I'm sure most of you have probably noticed we're into the season of the Winter Olympics, which traditionally is mainly carried out by Europeans. And winter sports, it's a European thing, isn't it? Europe is in the north, it's not in the south. We get lots of snow, we get lots of cold, harsh winters. And because of that, we've developed all these different ways for us to have fun in the snow. Skiing and ice skating and sledging and tobogganing. And it's because, as I say, we live in the north. That's why we developed these games and pastimes and turned them into sports. So you would not expect to see Somalians ice skating, or you wouldn't expect to see Arabs anywhere near the winter sports. But this is just being ignored, the reality of the matter, that Europe is in the north. And the Associated Press are complaining that the Winter Olympics teams are overwhelmingly white. And I'm getting this article from Breitbart. The AP, that's the Associated Press, accused several European nations competing in the Winter Olympics of having a lack of diversity on their teams, claiming they are overwhelmingly white. Imagine if you looked at something that was going on in Africa with black people in it and said, well, it's overwhelmingly black. They have a lack of white people. This isn't right. We need to start replacing the black people with white people. Obviously, that would be accused of being racist, but it seems absolutely fine for it to be seen as a negative thing just to have white people with other white people. It's as if we're not allowed to be with our own racial group anymore. All the time, we have to have other ethnic groups inserted into our own. In an article from the AP, the outlet highlighted how immigration from Africa and the Middle East has transformed the demographics of Europe in recent decades. And quite clearly, they think that that is a wonderful thing. I mean, another way to explain that would be immigration from Africa and the Middle East has replaced the original Europeans in most European countries in recent decades. And that's not a good thing, is it, that we are replacing our own people with people from outside, and then we're supporting drives like this to replace us even more. The outlet also noted that while the United States was sending one of its most diverse teams, the team rosters for countries such as France, Germany and Switzerland a lot like Sweden's, overwhelmingly white and lacking the immigrant representation. Why would the immigrants want to get involved in winter sports? I mean, some of these countries, they do have snow. I believe there's snow on the tops of Kilimanjaro. I believe they have mountains with snow in Syria. They do in Australia, but I don't think we're going to see any Aborigine skiing teams fairly soon. Just seems to be that it's something that white people enjoy. I mean, even if you look at, say, the Inuit, where they have snow all the time, there's no tradition of the Inuit going ice skating, for instance. It's just a European thing. And why should that be seen as somehow being wrong of Europeans to be doing this? Why shouldn't we be putting forth Africans as if they are part of the Swedish ethnic group and putting them forward to race for us. I guess maybe it's this same mentality as football, isn't it? Where you just import footballers from African countries and then claim that they represent your country. But at least in Africa, Africans do actually play football. And in Brazil, it is something that these other ethnic groups do actually take part in. But winter sports is not something that these other ethnic groups take part in. And I used to really enjoy skiing some years ago, decades ago, I used to go skiing. And one thing that you never see is a black skier or a black snowboarder. It was always white people there. And something else that always struck me at the time, that there was a massive amount of wealth that was just left outside. And you would leave your expensive skis, your expensive snowboard outside. I can remember walking through Switzerland, through the Alps and the shops there, and they had these fur coats worth thousands of pounds just on coat rails outside the shops. Nobody would ever thieve anything. There was no litter. And coincidentally, I'm sure it's just a coincidence, there was no black people there either. At the Milan Cortina Winter Olympics, Sweden is sending a team made up almost exclusively of ethnically Swedish athletes, with NHL player Mika Zibanejad, whose father is from Iran, a rare exception, the AP wrote. That hardly reflects the diversity of the Nordic country. Well, is that what the Olympics is about? Is it about reflecting the diversity of your country, or is it about winning medals? If it's about winning medals, you want the people that are best at the sport to be going forward and representing your country. What would be the point of having an African there that was no good at tobogganing and putting up an African toboggan team? You would lose the Olympics. Of course, the AP would cheer you on for putting black people there and replacing white people with black people, but you wouldn't actually win any medals. So why should a winter sports team reflect the so-called diversity of a Nordic country? About 2 million of its 10 million residents were born abroad, about half of them in Asia or Africa, according to National Statistics Agency SCB. Well, I would say, well, that's a reason why they're not in the sports team then, isn't it? Because they're not actually from Sweden. The AP has just told us there that 2 to 2 million, that's a fifth of the country, were actually born abroad. That means that they only arrived in the country in the last 10 years, 20 years. Why should they be being put forward as part of the Swedish skiing team? The AP article continued in part, "The lack of athletes of colour at the Winter Olympics and in winter sports in general has been a recurring theme in the United States, which is sending one of its most diverse teams to the Games. It hasn't gotten the same attention in Europe." Again, what are they saying here? Are they saying that white people are being racist to black people by not allowing them to get involved in winter sports? I just think they're not interested in winter sports. They're not interested in skiing and ice skating. I don't think they want to be out there in the remote wilderness at the top of a mountain. I think they would rather be in the warmth in a city somewhere rather than up there in a mountain, for the same reason why you don't tend to see many ethnic minorities hiking in the countryside, because it's just not something that they are interested in doing. The Olympic rosters of France, Germany, Switzerland and other European winter sports nations look a lot like Sweden's, overwhelmingly white and lacking the immigrant representation seen in their soccer or basketball teams. Again, it's because in places like Brazil and Africa, they do play soccer and basketball, but they don't go skiing and ice skating in those countries because it's not a natural environment for them as it is in the north. In the article, Marion Hashi, a Somali migrant who came to Sweden with her family in 2009, so she's literally only been in the country 15 years, explained to the outlet how it wasn't until 2018 that she discovered there was a ski slope 5 minutes from her home after a co-worker suggested she try snowboarding as part of a pilot integration project. So they clearly got projects here to try to get non-whites interested in skiing, just the same as over here in Britain. They're trying to insert black people and non-whites into the countryside. I mean, one of the reasons why I think perhaps black people and non-white people don't like to go in the countryside and go camping is possibly because it reminds them of being a refugee. It's the sort of thing that refugees have to do out in Africa. It's not taken up as a fun pastime to go and live under canvas. It's something that you do if your country's been ravaged by famine or ravaged by war, and you have to live in tents. Perhaps that could be a reason why black people and non-whites don't like camping as much as people in the West. I know that's a bit different to snowboarding and the skiing, but why should we just assume that these other racial groups would want to do the same things that we do? Why do we have to astroturf this and try to force these other groups to do the things that we do so that they can just replace us? It's almost as if there's somebody with an influence on this who just hates seeing white people anywhere and wants to see them replaced with other ethnic groups. When you don't have information or access, or anybody around you does it, snowboarding is basically a white sport. And when you are not correctly integrated into the community, you don't know much about it, Hashi told The Outlet. When you're not correctly integrated into the community. So she is saying that it's up to the Swedes. The Swedes have not done well enough at integrating her into their Swedish community. They haven't given her enough information about it or access. Well, she just said it was 5 minutes from her home, so it quite clearly it's easily accessible. I'm sure they have the information there written in Swedish about it. And anybody around there is obviously going to be interested in it. But she says here she doesn't have anybody around her that does this. And of course, that's because she's a Somali. Why would Somalis be interested in skiing? That's like, why would white people be interested in climbing up a coconut tree to get down a coconut? They wouldn't be, because coconut trees don't naturally occur in places like Britain in the north. It's just not something that you would be interested in doing. Joseph Farlan, who works as a professor of sport pedagogy at Umeå University in Sweden, explained to The Outlet how the children of non-European immigrants are unlikely to be introduced to sports that their parents are not familiar with. I mean, do we really have to ask an expert for that? I mean, this is the point that I'm making, is that people that aren't European are not going to be interested in doing things that Europeans do. They're going to do things that non-Europeans do, like going to mosque, for instance. Pointing to Isaac, whose parents are from Eritrea, or tennis players Mikael and Elias Weimer, whose parents migrated to Sweden from Ethiopia, he said the children of non-European immigrants are unlikely to be introduced to sports that their parents are not familiar with. Take the example of Isaac finding his way into football. It makes total sense because football exists in Eritrea. Skiing doesn't, Farlan said. I mean, do they really need an expert to tell them this? The United States is not alone in grappling with diversity in winter sports, the AP wrote in a post on X, which included a video. So they're literally grappling with it. That means that they are wrestling with diversity to try and insert it into winter sports. Why would you do that? Why can't you just have winter sports for white people and football and basketball for non-white people? Why do they have to mix everything up? I mean, it also shows that there is there's an instinct to separate off with your own group, just the same as when you look at schools, when you look at prisons, at lunchtime in the school, the ethnic groups will separate, and the Pakistanis will go with the Pakistanis, and the indigenous Britons will go with the Britons. When you're in prison, the same thing would happen, particularly in American prisons. One ethnic group will go one way, the other ethnic group will go the other way. It's only this artificiality that we try and force them together. And they're admitting that there, grappling with diversity. It means they have to wrestle. It means they're having some kind of difficulty in inserting brown people into winter sports. In Europe, immigration from Africa and the Middle East has rapidly changed the demographics of the top winter sports countries. That won't be reflected in their rosters for the Milan Cortina Winter Olympics. Why would it be reflected in it? Why would it? It's the same over here when they complain that brown people aren't interested in the countryside. Why would they be interested in the countryside? They didn't build the countryside. Why is it that we assume that all ethnic groups are going to think the same way that we do when all the evidence tells us otherwise? Wait, you're telling me people from the Middle East and Africa aren't dominating the alpine skiing events? One person wrote in a post. I, for one, am shocked that recent refugees from the eastern deserts of Syria are not dominating the Finnish ski jumping team, another person wrote. Why should diversity be limited by immigration? Where are China's Africans? Breitbart News' John Carney wrote in a post on X. Where are the African teams with Hispanics? Why not more whites on Zimbabwe's teams? As we all know, Somali migrants are renowned for their skill on the ski slopes. Daily Wire senior editor Cabot Phillips wrote in a post on X. I mean, it really does seem that anything that white people do, the mainstream media just want to insert brown people into it. They have this overwhelming urge to get rid of the white people from the picture and replace them with brown people. It's like they just want to scribble out white people and replace them with these others. And that just seems to be the mentality everywhere. Well, another subject that I wanted to talk about today was the resignation of Morgan McSweeney, who was basically the man behind Keir Starmer. And he has said that it was his responsibility for allowing Peter Mandelson to be the US trade envoy. And he's now fallen on his sword. And of course, people are saying, well, Keir Starmer also needs to fall on his sword for putting Peter Mandelson forward as this UK trade envoy, because he knew that he was involved with Epstein. And I'm looking at that and I'm thinking, well, perhaps that was the reason why they put him in this job. They knew that Donald Trump had something to do with Jeffrey Epstein. Perhaps he might have met Peter Mandelson at some point. So why don't we put Peter Mandelson forward as the trade envoy? They both must have met one another before at these parties. I mean, it's not beyond the realms of possibility that that is what was actually being thought by both Starmer and McSweeney. But anyway, McSweeney has now resigned, and I really hadn't heard of him before, but he's played quite an important role, actually, in attacking free speech. McSweeney played a critical role in Starmer's rise to power last year, having in large part orchestrated the takedown of former far-left Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn, who was ultimately kicked out of the party altogether last year, and having oversaw the return of the party to the new Labour structure of former Prime Minister Tony Blair. Part of McSweeney's efforts to depose Corbyn came in the form of censorship campaigns launched by his quote-unquote think tank, Labour Together, and its offshoot organisations Stop Funding Fake News and the Centre for Countering Digital Hate. So he is behind them. Stop Funding Fake News, of course, I mean, it's quite self-explanatory. That will be a campaign to intimidate advertisers from advertising on websites such as Twitter, which allow people to post about the things that are actually happening in their area, direct eyewitness posts, which they say are fake news. Your eyes are deceiving you with what you are actually seeing. And what's actually going on is what the mainstream media are telling you. So that's that organisation. And the Centre for Countering Digital Hate, that was the same organisation that was actually used for silencing COVID critics. What does COVID criticism have to do with online hate? Well, it has nothing to do with it. But the fact that they went after people that were critical of the COVID regime, the fact that the Centre for Countering Digital Hate actually went after them shows you that this isn't about protecting minorities from hate speech. It's about protecting the government narrative. Both COVID and hate speech are government narratives. And that's what this Center for Countering Digital Hate, that's what they were doing, protecting the government narrative, trying to silence people that are criticizing COVID, and trying to silence people for criticizing the government for the grooming gang policy. After successfully diminishing his rivals on the far left of the Labour Party, the censorship apparatus created by McSweeney was then used to censor and deplatform conservative news outlets in the United States, including Breitbart News. So they weren't just silencing people in Britain. They were going after America. The head of the Center for Countering Digital Hate and a longtime McSweeney ally, Imran Ahmed, was among five British and European citizens sanctioned in December by the Trump administration for their role in leading organized efforts to coerce American platforms to censor, demonetize, and suppress American viewpoints that they oppose. And we did a podcast about that as well. So the main guy at the Center for Countering Digital Hate, he has now been sanctioned. And the other person involved in it, Morgan McSweeney, he has now been forced to resign, which is good news. And if we go back a few years, we can have a look at some of the things that this McSweeney was responsible for, or at least the group that he was involved with were responsible for. A group with direct links to the government of the United Kingdom and to senior members of the UK Labour Party has taken credit for having websites Zero Hedge and The Federalist threatened with suspension of service by Google Ads. Of course, all of these frontmen for these organisations, they say, oh, we're nothing to do with censorship. We're nothing to do with that. We don't force companies to stop posting that content. We just make them aware of who it is that's creating the hate speech. But of course, they put the pressure on that company to defund the person that is making the posts. The same as the ADL in America put pressure on social media companies to silence people. And they say, oh, well, we're not censoring them. We're just letting the social media company know who it is that's making the hate speech. So effectively, what they're doing is they're telling the social media company who it is they need to be censoring. They may not be forcing them to, but the social media company knows that if they don't go along with what they've been told to do by these NGOs, that they will then be accused of being haters themselves. They'll be accused of being racists for not removing it from their platform. So that's the way that this works. And this is why, quite rightly, Donald Trump has sanctioned Imran Ahmed, the head of the Center for Countering Digital Hate. And this unexpected event now that's come as a result of these Jeffrey Epstein files is that this Morgan McSweeney has now had to resign. Research conducted by the Center for Countering Digital Hate, a UK anti-hate non-profit, is stated to be behind the bans, according to NBC, which reported that the Federalist had been banned by tech giant Google after the NBC News Verification Unit brought the CCDH research to their attention. So again, these organisations that claim to be the arbiters of truth, who can verify whether something is true or not. Of course, don't forget that the BBC is seen as one of these people that can verify whether things are true or not. That's the same BBC that doctored a Donald Trump speech to make him say the opposite of what he was actually saying. So the NBC News Verification Unit were the ones that forwarded this CCDH research. So they're effectively working in line with them. So these organizations that pretend to be non-profit charities, they're all part of the same mainstream media apparatus, basically. The original NBC story was in error and was later corrected to state that the Federalist has not yet been blacklisted by Google, but has been warned of imminent suspension from Google Ads due to policy violations in its comments section. Zero Hedge is working with Google to resolve its blacklisting, which was for similar reasons. So again, because these companies allowed people to freely comment in their comment section, well within American law, but because these comments were critical of certain government policies, these charities swoop in there, the Center for Countering Digital Hate, and they warn the advertisers off and say, look, stop giving these people your money. If you don't stop giving these people your money, we're going to call you racist. And that's effectively blackmail, isn't it? But that's what they do. NBC spoke to CCDH's CEO, Imran Ahmed, who said his group has been targeting companies which have expressed support for the Black Lives Matter movement, asking them to suspend advertising to websites that oppose the Black Lives Matter agenda. So again, that's overtly political, isn't it? Black Lives Matter is a left-wing organization. It's a political movement. And this so-called non-aligned Center for Countering Digital Hate, they're obviously showing their support for Black Lives Matter and trying to get people that oppose Black Lives Matter, trying to get them deplatformed. We found that lots of those companies are inadvertently funding, through their advertising, content that is outright racist in defense of white supremacism and contains conspiracy theories about George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter movement, he stated. Websites targeted by CCDH's Defund Racism campaign include Breitbart News, WorldNet Daily, The Gateway Pundit, American Thinker, American Greatness, and The Federalist, which is incorrectly marked on the organization's website as defunded, even though Google says it has not yet pulled ads from the site. So they're even bragging about this. They even put it up on their website. They're really proud of the fact that they have censored all these different viewpoints. And this is one of the issues. Our opponents do think that what they're doing is right. They think they're morally right. They think they're doing a good thing by silencing the opposition, which is effectively what they're doing. They will say, oh, we're not silencing the opposition. We're just removing hate speech and hypocrisy because these companies have said they support Black Lives Matter. And yet they're also advertising on websites that don't support Black Lives Matter. Well, effectively, what they're trying to do is interfere with the free speech of America, aren't they? They're saying, well, we want free speech. You can promote what we say about Black Lives Matter, but you're not allowed to promote what the alternative says, what the opposition says. And this is blackmail as well, because they are obviously threatening them with putting them up on their website and saying that they're racists who support white supremacists if they don't remove the alternative view. CCDH's website smears Breitbart News with the false claim that the site pushed the theory that Barack Obama was born in Kenya. As evidence, the organization cites a story that explicitly rejects the theory. That's often what we see with these left-wing organizations. Their evidence that somebody had said something will in a lot of cases actually be that that person has said the complete opposite. But they seem to think that we're giving out secret messages to people and the things that we say. We don't actually mean what we are quite obviously saying, but we are secretly trying to influence them in other ways. Mr. Ahmed, a UK national, also sits on the steering committee of the UK government's Commission for Countering Extremism, another independent, so-called independent, advisory board that recently stated it would examine whether or not it would be possible to criminalise behaviour that leads to extremism and hatred. So criminalising completely legal behaviour. That's what they're saying there. It's not good enough for them that they've banned us from abbreviating certain words or using old-fashioned English, but they want to ban us for thinking about possibly using old-fashioned English. And this also shows you that this organization, the Center for Combating Online Hate, it's linked up with this government commission for countering extremism. So again, it all comes from the government and the mainstream media. So Mark Rowley, former head of counterterrorism in the UK, leads the commission and stated earlier this month, after some initial scoping, I'm convinced that the Commission's clarity of focus on hateful extremism can help identify the gaps that exist at the boundaries of current laws, such as hate crime and terrorism, which are being exploited daily by extremists. Well, they're not extremists, are they, if they're not actually breaking the law? That's what this hateful extremism term meant. It meant somebody that's not actually breaking the law, but we don't like what they're saying. Also serving on the commission is Nick Lowles of the far-left anti-hate activist group Hope Not Hate, which was identified as being linked to far-left extremism. In a Swedish Defence Research Agency report published in May of 2018. So Nick Lowles is in this as well. So we've got Imran Ahmed, we've got the guy from the Centre for Countering Digital Hate. He's now not allowed to visit America. He's got sanctions on him. We now have Morgan McSweeney, who's had to resign over corruption issues, over Peter Mandelson corruptly giving away information to other Jews, inside information on the British British government. And linked in with those two is this Nick Lowles. I wonder if we'll ever see Nick Lowles being removed from his position. Funded by Hungarian-American billionaire George Soros, Hope Not Hate has also been linked to the far-left extremist Antifa movement, which President Donald Trump has pushed to declare a terrorist organization in the United States following its involvement in the BLM riots after the death of George Floyd. And, of course, after the death of Charlie Kirk, he's also said the same. And I don't know whether they have been designated as a terrorist organization yet. Certainly, Antifa are not being treated in the same way as, say, a group like the Nordic Resistance is, which was outlawed as a terrorist organization by the American state. Hope Not Hate was also the recipient of an undisclosed amount of money from Google themselves last year. And then I think this is 2020, sorry. Last year, after the Institute for Strategic Dialogue, in partnership with Google, gave the group cash as part of their innovation fund to counter hate and extremism in the UK. Actually, a fund to silence people that are critical of these government policies. Well, Mr. Ahmed is labelled as the CEO of CCDH. According to company's house filing records, the only two board members for the non-profit are Dr. Siobhan Marie McAndrew, a University of Bristol sociology lecturer, and Kirsty Jean McNeil, Executive Director of Policy Advocacy and Campaigns for the charity Save the Children. So even with a charity which is supposed to be pretty good, Save the Children, we want to save children, we don't want children to die, but even they are linked up with this. They're linked up with this CCDH as well. According to her LinkedIn page, Miss McNeil is not only a charity executive, but is also a council member of the European Council on Foreign Relations, a group that was partially founded by and received startup funding from George Soros's Open Society Foundations. They're all linked together, aren't they? Well, the anti-hate organisations, the European Council on Foreign Relations, Save the Children, strategy director for Keir Starmer, Morgan McSweeney, the trade envoy, Peter Mandelson, Nick Lowles. They're all linked in together, aren't they? I wonder whether the Jeffrey Epstein files will show any links to Hope Not Hate. McNeil also served as strategy director for former Labour Party leader Gordon Brown, who is also a noted supporter of Hope Not Hate, and from 2007 to 2011 served as a special advisor to the UK Prime Minister's office at 10 Downing Street. It's very incestuous, this, isn't it? Companies House lists two other former directors of CCDH, including Mr. Morgan James McSweeney, who is now the Chief of Staff of Labour's party leader, Sir Keir Starmer. McSweeney also influences the UK's main opposition party through his present role as director of the group Labour Together. And of course, that's what we started with in the other article, where the organisation that took down Jeremy Corbyn. Populism divides our country. We will not bring our country back together by shouting through megaphones, setting up single-issue protest parties, or abusing people in leaflets or online. It's easy to play the politics of hate and shout louder, but harder to do what's really needed and create a politics of hope, Labour Together writes on its website. Ah, such hypocrites, aren't they? I mean, just at this protest that I went to at the weekend, that is exactly what the opposition were trying to do. They were trying to shout through megaphones and shut down so that people couldn't hear what the other side had to say. And all their placards were about smash the fash and Nazi scum, all this sort of stuff. Is that not the politics of hate? Now, everything that they have on their placards is showing hate for their opponents. You don't see that amongst nationalists. You don't see hate for our opponents anywhere. You see the country's flags. You see concern about government policies, and you see concern about our people. Nothing about hate. But when you look at the opponents, it's all hate. And yet they have the audacity to pretend that they're all about hope. So it's good to see that Morgan McSweeney has had to resign, especially on top of the CEO of Countering Digital Hate, him also being sanctioned by America. As I say, I wonder if we'll ever see old Nick Lowles being asked to step down. There was a member of Hope Not Hate that was recently charged with child abuse offences, and he was also linked in with the Labour Party. And of course, I think we'll still see more from these Jeffrey Epstein files. I am surprised that they put all those files out, to be honest. I mean, do they not come under confidence, privacy, that sort of thing? I mean, just because somebody's been arrested or found guilty of a crime, does that mean that all their private emails can be made public? I'm wondering just how this has actually happened, that they've been able to do this. I guess they say it's because of the public interest, maybe. I do know that in America they had to pass an act to actually get this information put out there. And I just wonder where else it's going to end up. Could we see Nick Lowles going as well? Well, we live in hope. Well, thank you very much for listening. I will be back tomorrow with more of the Daily Nationalist for you. God bless and hail victory.